Greetings! This is Dungeons and Devices, a podcast about role-playing games, computer games, and technology, and various related topics. And this is episode 3, Composing Quests, the Symphony of Soundscapes. I am your host, Leonard, and today we are talking about music. You might wonder how music relates to our usual subjects, and if we think about music, music is an integral and essential part of movies and computer games and even role-playing games, because we Dungeon Masters like to play various musics during our sessions. One particular type of music, orchestral music or cinematic music, is a big favorite for all of these, so movies and computer games and role-playing games as well. Everybody is probably familiar with what orchestral music is. There are many composers who make orchestral music and who are probably very familiar to us, starting from John Williams, Hans Zimmer, Klaus Badelt, or Jasper Kidd, Ramin Djawadi, and there are probably hundreds more who specialize in this kind of music. How is this kind of music made, and what does it involve to compose this kind of music? That is what I would like to talk today. And my guest is Matti Paalanen, who is an indie producer from Finland, who has focused on the digital music business and its possibilities in the past years. He runs Ouranio Recordings label and at least tries his best to stay up to date regarding music technology and the possibilities that the ever-changing digital realm has to offer when it comes to music production and marketing. Welcome, Matti.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I mentioned a few composers. Do you have any favorites to add to the list who you listen to or who inspires you during your musical journey?
Yeah, it's a good question. I probably would have to say, first and foremost, Michael Hoenig. I don't know how to pronounce it appropriately, but he was the one who was responsible for the Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 video game soundtracks back in the day. And I still remember the first time I installed Baldur's Gate 1. It came with like 5 CDs because it was like one of the first games that was so massive for PCs. And when I started playing it, already the menu theme that you hear when you like start the game was so epic and full of like this kind of fantasy movie vibe that I was instantly like thinking that, oh man, if video games are starting to sound like this, we are in for a treat, which we were. And another composer a few years later, which created this kind of similar, oh man, this is something really gorgeous, was Jeremy Soule, when he did like the Elder Scrolls series soundtracks, starting from Morrowind. The Morrowind soundtrack was like, and still is, one of my all-time favorites. But yeah, Hans Zimmer, of course, is like one of the guys that I still listen to very much. But yeah, Michael Hoenig and Jeremy Soule has been some of my all-time favorites.
And was this the same reason why you got interested in music production? Or how did that start?
Yeah, it relates to that. I'm a role player since the 80s. I started with the original Redbox Dungeons and Dragons when I was like under 10 years old, because one of the bit older kids who lived in the nearby neighborhood already had started to Dungeon Master games, and he was always looking for guys to play with. So we created this group and played for quite a few years and continued from there. But yeah, we had this culture of using background music in our sessions with my friends, and we were always thinking about the options, that what kind of soundtrack would fit the campaigns or the one-shot games. And it's sort of like, because music was always quite important hobby for me, it was quite sort of like natural to think that at some point I might start thinking about doing some custom soundtracks for my games or friends' games. So it came from like these two kinds of angles, both the tabletop role-playing game context and need, but also this just the enjoyment of the computer video game soundtracks and getting inspired by those, thinking that, hey, it would be cool to try and recreate some kind of musical atmospheres that you personally have enjoyed and heard in games.
How does one get started making music? Because I assume you don't have your own personal orchestra at home. So
yeah, that would be awesome to have. But yeah, sadly, we are not there yet. Originally, when I started to sort of like explore this realm, it was probably in 2004 or 2005. Most of the tools that were available back then were quite crude in comparison to today. And one can say that the music technology has evolved and progressed with an insane speed in the past two decades. So at that time, you could basically have some tools in just normal desktop PC, but the CPU and memory requirements and hard drive like sizes were still so like limited that it wasn't really feasible for a normal person to do anything that the professional composers were able to do. Even if Hans Zimmer was really doing quite a lot of things digitally, even back then, he probably had like insane servers, people, engineers just like setting it up all up for him because it required so much hardware. But for me, the first step I started to dabble with was Digital Audio Workstation, or DAW, DAW, that sort of like refers to the actual composing program that you install on your Mac or Windows. And for me, the choice was Steinberg's Cubase. But there are like quite a lot of different DAWs, and every composer sort of like picks the one that he enjoys the most from the UI perspective. But basically, most of the professional DAWs are quite similar to the way how they work and possibilities that they offer. So it's more like a preference thing. But Cubase is a program that is designed to create music. So it's sort of like a virtual mixer table. So you have like this opportunity to add tracks, and you can sort of like define that is this specific track pure audio track, is meant for recording stuff from microphones, then it basically just generates wave file inside it. Or is it the so-called instrument or MIDI track, which is meant to be attached to some kind of sound library that resides in your PC on your hard drive. And these sample libraries already back in the day were sort of like this kind of massive collection of pre-recorded WAV files. For example, give you opportunity to play with an instrument that you don't actually have, but you want to use it to generate music with. So for example, I don't play violin, but in many tunes I would like to actually still have violin included in the music. So I could purchase a violin sound library, and somebody has recorded quite a lot of different ways of playing violin and all the notes that violin can play in a good studio. And then they have like thousands of WAV files with pristine sounding violin. And then they create this kind of programming logic on top of those WAV files that allow one to control the virtual violin with MIDI keyboard. So basically a piano. And when you play with the piano keyboard, it sends these MIDI signals to your virtual like instrument track. And then you actually record those notes, those MIDI notes that you're playing with your piano. And you can have different kind of extra controller information as well, like pushing and pulling different sliders, which give like extra information on top of your piano playing. And then depending on the virtual violin library, it somehow programmatically defines that if you hear this note and this kind of pushing, pulling controller information is included, then we know that we actually load these and these WAV files from our library and merge them together, creating a natural sounding violin line with legatos and switches from this wave to this wave and so on. So this is basically the idea that you can almost any instrument virtualize and pack into these kinds of tools that you can integrate into your DAW. And then when you create your tracks, you just define that this track will be attached to this virtual instrument, and this track will be attached to this virtual instrument. And then when you play the notes with your MIDI keyboard, you can actually make it sound like whatever instrument you actually want. And the main sort of like thing that comes from this is that the MIDI information and the MIDI track itself is so distinct from the libraries that you can basically even afterwards just switch the library so that if you have played a line and you originally thought that it would be a violin line, you can afterwards just switch that, hey, I actually want to change the violin to, let's say, harp. And then the already existing MIDI notes and all the stuff that you have on the track work as it is. It just suddenly sounds like a harp because you just switch the connection. So it allows this kind of modification of your projects if you compare it to WAV files. Because if you originally recorded with microphone a violin WAV file, there is not much that you can do to it afterwards. Because if you want to switch that to harp, you're in trouble. It allows this kind of quite lenient like way of approaching the composing process.
And you mentioned that there are thousands of files even for one instrument. So this is not anything like back in the 90s, we had these tracker programs where you had one instrument and then the tracker would like shift the pitch and play it on different levels and different notes by manipulating the sound. So this is not the case here. We actually have for the different notes actual like samples. So it sounds more natural, I would assume.
Yeah, so that's sort of like the balancing act that the more you record the pre sort of like recorded files, the more massive your library becomes. And back in the day, it was usual that the libraries were like a couple of gigabytes, which was really a massive thing for those era desktop machines. But of course, these days when you have terabytes of space easily on SSDs, you can basically just put as much WAV files as you really need. But sometimes it's also like there are these companies that approach this kinds of virtualization of instrument. Some of them are like totally programmatical so that they don't even have any WAV files. They sort of like try to create the physical aspect of the instrument in totally like algorithmic way. So they sort of like try to analyze that how the violin body actually works when the string is being played and how it generates the actual sound. So if we can virtualize the body of the violin and the string and the bow, then we can actually create this kind of actual virtual violin that doesn't really need any WAV files from the studio. But I haven't really like enjoyed those, at least yet, because even if they are quite good these days, they still sound a bit too weird to my ears. So I prefer this kind of actual recording of an actual player and actual violin.
All right. And just to clarify a few things, because I don't know if everybody knows how MIDI files work. So MIDI files are basically just recording the musical notes. If we want to simplify things, if you play a piano, a MIDI file will know what key you touched, how hard you pressed it, how long you pressed it, and this is recorded in a MIDI file. So it's like instructions on how to play the instrument.
Yeah, exactly. If traditional pianists need the notes on a paper telling that how the song goes, and then they read the notes, and when they read the notes, they know how to actually play it on the piano with their fingerings. MIDI is basically a notation, but it's just in digital form without the paper and the notes. So it tells that what the notes are, when they are played, how long. And the addition is that you can have these kinds of controller information on top of that, which can tell you that when you are holding these notes, we want you to play a bit louder and then a bit like so you can sort of like add these extra informations on top.
And you mentioned that you add several tracks, and some can be digital soundtracks and some are these MIDI tracks. And so each of the tracks is basically one player in your orchestra.
Yeah, but it also depends a bit because some of the libraries, especially these days, can have quite a lot of programming on top of them, which can allow you to, for example, just on one track, if you have like a violin library, let's say, you can basically play, for example, four notes on top of each other, which would sort of like mean that you need four violinists to actually play like four notes at the same time. But the library can have this kind of way of realizing that, hey, we are seeing four notes on top of each other, so we know that we actually have to fetch different wave files and actually make it sound like four different violinists are playing on top of each other.
Yeah, but if we think about real orchestra, they also like many times multiple violinists playing basically the same thing. It's just that there are more violins playing. So I guess this is something similar.
Yeah, and quite often you also in virtual environment want to duplicate things that you can actually have like three different tracks sending information to three different sound libraries, but the MIDI notes or MIDI structure can be still the same on all of those tracks. So you're sort of like just making that melodic line a little bit more full when you have it like playing the same on different versions of the instrument or totally different instruments doing the same thing, like stacking violin and some woodwind or a brass, for example.
I was wondering, do you know if it is usual today that the composers work digitally, and is it only the big ones who actually use a real orchestra?
I don't have like the first-hand experience, so I can be wrong about this. But what I've heard or understood is that most of the modern composers, even Hans Zimmer, do quite a lot of work in a virtual, like digital environments when building the soundtracks. And then I guess it sort of like depends a bit on the movie production, the budget and the director and everything that relates to that specific film and how it's being made, that will they decide at the end of the day when the soundtrack is getting finished and approved and so on, that will they finally go to the studio and actually record the final soundtrack with live orchestra and probably even then maybe stacking that live recording with something digital as well. And of course, it's quite specialized that you have different people actually doing the mixing, and you have even different people doing the master. So it can be quite a big pool of people with specific roles that finally sort of like make up the finished product. Also in the phase where they're actually building the songs, even if it mentions that Hans Zimmer is the composer, I wouldn't be surprised if actually involve quite a big team of composers.
Well, I would imagine that having all these digital tools actually makes the life of a composer easier. Now you can just sit at home and listen to the final version already while you are working on it, even before you have to like give it to actual people to play it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that like every once in a while, that how different it is and how different it was. And it's also like I don't have that kind of skill that, for example, Sibelius had, that he would like hear everything inside his head. And even if he was deaf and didn't have piano or didn't have any use of piano anymore, he could still compose and write like symphonies because he had it in his head, like at that level of clarity. I guess that sort of like back in the day, being a composer required quite specific way of how your brains work. But these days, when the tools have evolved and everything, it sort of like makes it possible for more varied like people to make reasonable music, because they are not like that heavily dependent on those specific skills or specific abilities that you have to have. It's more about like the just that if you have a certain musicality in you, then you can find your way of making it work for you.
So you would say that having all these digital tools has lowered the bar of entry for somebody to start?
Yeah, definitely. And for example, I don't have like that kind of classical background. Like when I was younger, I had like piano lessons and I did some theory, but nothing in comparison to those who actually go to like university degree in composition or arrangement, but still it allows me to make reasonable stuff even when I don't have like the actual deep knowledge of how the classical composition works. Or
what if somebody would ask that they want to play your music with a live orchestra? Would it be easy to transfer what you have done digitally inside the computer onto like note papers and give it to real musicians?
Yeah, it's surprisingly straightforward. I haven't really done that, but for example, in Cubase, when you have the MIDI tracks, you can basically export notation of those MIDI tracks, depending how good you are when you're arranging the song. And if you have like this intention that I actually want a live orchestra someday to play this, there are like some things that you have to take into account. Like, let's say, understanding that what are the notes that violinist can actually play and not doing something really crazy, or like these kind of ideas.
Now, you mentioned that you were inspired by some computer role-playing games and their music. Certainly, you have also composed your own works, and you also do cover works for other compositions. How would you characterize that, working on covers? What makes it so exciting? Is it something similar to what many people think when they write fan fiction, when they read a book and they enjoy it so much that they then write fan fiction? Is working on covers something similar?
Usually I do covers of songs that I enjoy and the original versions are important to me. And then I have this kind of feeling that I might be able to bring something fresh or new or alternative or different. So yeah, definitely that fanfic kind of idea or angle. The other angle is that if you are like an Indian musician or composer, and I personally intentionally try to keep myself sort of like off the limelight, so to speak. I don't like enjoy having attention shown towards me as an artist, that I rather just want people to find the music and enjoy the music, but not really care too much who I am. That brings the problem that if I make a song and I don't really want to be out there as myself, then the question is, why would anyone sort of like listen to my song or even find out that I have a song out there? Covers are usually more easily organically found than your original compositions, because if you do a cover of something that's already quite well known and quite popular among the fans of the original franchise, then it tends to be that people are sometimes just searching and looking that, hey, are there any versions of these classic songs or important songs to us that have people versioned them? And then if you create a version, then it can be that some people just find it and find you and your music. So there are like these two things, that you're on the other hand just thinking that it would be cool to do your version, but also hoping that by doing that version you get your music out there a bit more like easily than just doing your own thing.
So covers work sort of like a marketing for you.
Yeah, it's like one aspect of figuring out this kind of what's reasonable.
When you have finished your composition and you have a music, then it needs to go somewhere. And you also have your own recording label so that you publish your own music. I guess that is the way indie things are done these days. Can you like make a quick summary of how you ended up doing a record label, and does it involve a lot of work, and how does your music end up in a place like Spotify?
Yeah, these days it's actually quite like simple, because the economy has sort of like progressed to a point where there are quite a lot of different companies out there who have their specific role in that whole thing. And for example, where the end result is having a music on all the different streaming platforms. So there are like these, I guess the term is aggregate, these aggregate companies that sort of like are open to any indie musician or composer. And you pick an aggregate and then you just start publishing your music through your chosen aggregate, and the aggregate digitally takes the responsibility of getting your music, the actual WAV files and the album art, and then publishing that in all of the different streaming services. It doesn't really involve a lot of work because if you think that what was the main role of major labels, let's say in the 90s or era before that even, the music production was sort of like in a way gatekeeped, because only reasonable way for anybody to actually have your music heard anywhere was either in the radio stations, or you had to have like a physical shelf place for your physical albums that you needed to print somehow. And the music that you were able to print on that album required first some kind of studio session, because the virtual studios were not really a thing. So you had to go to a place where you have to spend a few days recording stuff with microphones and mixing and mastering. And when you finally get the end product, then you have to print it on the CD or LP or whatever. And then even after that, have to get the shelf place. So it made sense that the majors were the only way to make that happen. And that was sort of like the thing why people needed to get signed and needed to get the deal to make any of that actually happen, even if they already had the idea for the music. But these days, as you can generate the music on your own, on your desktop PC, you can just digitally transform that WAV file into to streaming services. You can sort of like get rid of all those things that were mandatory back in the day. That sort of like changed quite a lot about this whole business, because if you have an idea for a song, you can actually create it and actually publish it right away.
Would you say that if somebody makes good music and is an indie artist, that he or she can make a living by just using streaming services to distribute?
Well, it's possible, and there are a growing number of indie musicians and producers like all around the world who are more and more getting towards this kind of idea that they actually can live off the streaming. But it's not easy. And it's not guaranteed, or it's not like something that you can just decide that, hey, I do it and it works. Because it's also very competitive. And because the bar is lower, more and more people are like going to try it every year. And the amount of music that's being published every day is growing. So it's sort of like this kind of weird realm where everything is in constant change. And what sort of like looked like something 2 years ago, it can suddenly look a bit different, the music.
Let's now talk a bit about vocals. I know that you experimented with vocals and vocal generation. What made you experiment with this? And obviously it's not easy to find someone to sing for your song.
I have dabbled around with like practicing my singing like in the past 10 years or so, and I can do something with my voice. But obviously when we go to these kind of fantasy themes and stuff like that, it's not necessarily my voice, even if it would be like really good, to make sense in that context. Usually I look for like female vocals or ethereal, like elven kind of vibe that I just can't do on my own. So yeah, it comes from those kind of requirements or needs that, hey, I need this kind of vocal, how can I get it done? Technology has evolved in this sense as well in the past few years quite a lot and quite fast. So one product that I found was, I guess it was a Japanese company, but they published this kind of tool called Synthesizer V. And based on the like the information that they give, I guess there is some kind of neural network thing going on. So they have probably went to a studio with some singers, and they have somehow analyzed the vocals that human generates. Somehow the neural network can analyze the formants and how the words are generated from the syllables and stuff like that. And they have somehow matched that audio like understanding to the text. So the neural network can somehow receive English sentences, and then it can generate the necessary vocal formants from that text based on the singer's voice that they had in the studio. So basically they like allow you to purchase distinct singers that you can sort of like then have in your synthesizer V. And then when you write English, that singer will always be the one that sings those English words in the melody that you define in your MIDI. And it works surprisingly well. I'd say that in some cases, there are like weird moments that sound a bit artificial or funky, but not in disturbing way. So I've in a few songs just like created lead melody line with synthesizer V, writing everything in English. And it just like sounds like almost that I would have a session singer doing it in my studio.
For the indie industry, this is an important step. But do you feel that like more bigger or commercial projects will also start using virtual singers in the future?
Time will tell. I think that vocals tend to be so big part of the traditional artist, like the business, because when you're doing live gigs, it's still going to be probably one of the biggest elements that you are actually singing there on the stage. But when it comes to media music and soundtrack music and such, maybe. At least the some of the vocal layers that are more on the background, I wouldn't be surprised if they're being like more and more, at least partially, being like layered with virtual ones.
And I also think that this could be a tool used to, in the same way that we discussed, that virtual instruments can be used to preview what you are doing before doing it really. So you can actually hear your song being performed quite easily during the creative process.
Yeah, definitely. I have been sort of like experimenting now with actually doing some like vocal sessions, having a vocalist here in my studio and singing lines. And it's usually very reasonable to make a demo version of the vocal lines by using, for example, synthesizer V, so that the singer can hear it before he or she comes to sing it herself. Because just hearing it in some kind of vocal like way, instead of like just having a piano or somebody, some instrument like mimicking the line, it helps you sort of like understand that what's we are after.
Okay, now that we touched a bit on the vocal part, move on to another part, music generation. I have also experimented with some music generation tools, but the results were quite bad. One tool I found that they generated for me 4 tracks of music, 4 instruments. Maybe the tracks made like sense in themselves, but when you played the 4 together, it was like this cacophony of noise, and it didn't sound like music. There were some tools that kind of sound okay, but I wouldn't say it's ready for prime time yet, and yet they were asking money for it. Do you have any experience with actually generating music by artificial intelligence?
I ran into this, I don't remember if it was Google Labs or some Google project that published some this kind of generative music from prompts. The latest one that I experimented with was already sounding pretty okay, actually surprisingly good. But I don't think that they went public with it. It was more like this kind of experimenting that they just showed that, hey, we managed to do this, but this is not like meant for live use for people. I'd say that probably the neural networks can and will learn to generate really, really excellent music, much in the sense that, for example, Midjourney can generate really good images already. Because I don't see that there's like any big difference between how Midjourney learns from massive pool of images. If you have a good dataset of music and you somehow attach that dataset with the necessary like prompt information, I think that the modern era neural networks can effectively generate reasonable music. But I think that from business perspective, the biggest challenge or open question, so to speak, is that in the realm of photography and illustrations, there haven't been like these kind of parties that would have the necessary strength to somehow prevent from Midjourney from happening. But in music circles, the big labels like Universal Music and Sony and Warner, and they are still sort of like so aggressively on the fence, like demanding that any music that we have in our catalog must not be used in AI. And if you generate something that has been learned with our music, we are going to take it down. I think this is probably the only reason currently that this music generation AI is not really moving forward with the speed that, for example, the image and video AIs are. It remains to be seen that how will it play out, because I'm quite sure that at some point we will get reasonable music generation AIs.
Maybe it's because I'm not a musician myself, but it's very difficult for me to imagine how such an AI could work. Because if I think of images, it's quite easy to describe what I would like to see. But would those same words convey exactly what I want from a musical piece?
Well, if I were to sort of like plan or make that kind of AI, let's say a Midjourney for music, I guess it comes down to the how you sort of like handle the actual learning data set of music and the prompts. I would guess that, I don't know how the Midjourney thing works, but I would guess that you would have to have a more like specific pools of music in the learning phase, so that you would manually beforehand know that, okay, in this specific pool of music, we only have like jazz standards that include like Miles Davis kind of vibe, that you have this specific instrumentation and specific stylistical angle to it. There's usually like a trumpet and this kind of jazz band and stuff like that. And then you sort of like attach different prompts that specifically are related to that kind of genre and that aesthetic and so on. And then you would have a different pool for Hans Zimmer, like massive pompous trailer music. Even within that, distinct pools for like pirate music and stuff like that. So I guess that you would somehow need to define these kind of how different musics are genre-wise or stylistically pooled together, and then make sure that specific prompts are actually sort of like understood the right way. But I don't know, because the neural networks are getting so damn good that maybe they could be able to just actually learn it from the massive, like every music in the world, and just looking at how people are like talking or describing the songs. Maybe they could be able to just come up with the right attachments between the language and the sound.
And if I will be able to say, give me happy jazz music, will we need composers in the future?
I would say that in specific cases, the workload of composers is definitely getting smaller. And I'd say that the first context to be sort of like driven by AI more and more are like the simple advertisement jingles and simple media music in general, underscore kind of stuff that doesn't really require the Hans Zimmer masterpieces or powerful melodies, but more like this ambient kind of vibe that media music companies are dishing out for advertisement. I think that in the next few years, I wouldn't be surprised that most of the advertisement companies are starting to use more and more just generated AI ambient and jingles. I wouldn't necessarily believe that AI would somehow make human music obsolete. I think that it will just sort of like more clearly define that where lays the main point of human touch, so to speak. And I think that when humans are listening to music, in many occasions, they are somehow looking for that connection. And I think that AIs are still, they are not really good at that. They are good at mimicking and generating something similar. But when you need something really specific, nobody has the time to try it like 200 times, trying to find the right prompt where one word can make the difference. But the human can easily find the necessary thing right away. And I think that that's the realm where the composers are still going to be quite valid.
Okay, I think our time is coming to an end, so I would like to thank you for joining me today. It was a really great discussion, and it was nice to hear what goes on behind the scenes when we listen to some composition on Spotify. And I myself use a lot of music in my role-playing games. Some of are your compositions, actually.
Thank you. Glad to hear that they have been of use, because that's usually the idea, that hopefully somebody will find some place for these songs as well in the sessions. So yeah, it was a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Matti. You can listen to music by Matti on Spotify if you search for Celestial Ion Project. I will also put up a link for that in the show notes. Thank you for listening. You have been listening to episode 3 of Dungeons and Devices, a podcast about role-playing games, computer games, technology, gadgets, and gaming. I am your host, Leonard. Intro and outro music is Boss Battle from Celestial Aeon Project and Everrune. Dungeons and Devices releases new episodes every second Thursday. You can find this podcast in most podcasting apps, including Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, or Amazon. If you would like to subscribe, go to dungeonsanddevices.com, where you can also join in on the discussions, or email us at podcast@dungeonsanddevices.com. Farewell until our next quest together.